Welcome to session 204. This is our session is entitled Keeping Up with the Deluge, Managing Digital Collections Responsibly with Limited Resources. I am the chair of this session. My name is Andrea Buchner. I am the director of the Digital Laboratory at the Center for Jewish History. I am in charge of a couple of digitization projects and the management of digital assets at the center. And as the title of the session already implies, it is about managing digital collections responsibly with limited resources. It is a lot about archivists who work in single-person shops and who don't have many resources at their disposal, but who are still able to manage digital projects successfully. And we will be talking about some creative solutions that they came up with, which involved the creation of metadata and also the forming of consortia that will help archivists with limited resources to achieve their digitization goals. It is my pleasure to introduce our three speakers today. Our first speaker will be Andrea Medina-Smith. She worked as the digital archivist for the Jewish Women's Archives at Brookline, Massachusetts. She helped implement a very basic Fedora repository. She loves metadata, and she cataloged more oral histories than she cares to remember. She will be speaking about the life cycle of metadata, the importance of metadata for the archivist and the user, and how important it is, about the importance of metadata when it comes to managing digital assets effectively and to not get lost in it. Our second speaker is Lisa Schoberg. She is the college archivist at Concordia College in Moorhead. She has been working at the Concordia College Archives since 2004, during which time she has joined forces with local organizations to form Digital Horizons, which is a regional digital repository. And she will be talking about how collaboration with other institutions can help an archivist with limited resources to create sustainable digital collections. And our third speaker is Robert Russell. He's currently the interim library director at Northern State University, where he's also continuing to serve as university archivist. He has been at Northern State University for 5 years and has been a professional archivist since 9 years. He will provide us with examples for successful digital projects and how they were able to complete these projects successfully. And I will now let Andrea speak.
Good morning, everyone. Let me just get everything set up. I hope everyone is having a wonderful conference so far. There we go. So again, my name is Andrea Medina-Smith, and I was the digital archivist at the Jewish Women's Archive. It is a national nonprofit dedicated to the uncovering, chronicling, and general exposure of unheralded Jewish women's stories in North America. So my presentation, entitled All the Ducks in a Row, Metadata Collection and Creation as Part of the Digital Asset Lifecycle. I will not be tweeting during this session, but if anybody does follow Twitter, my somewhat ridiculous handle is DinaDina619. And you know, maybe later I can tell you what that's about. All right. Okay. So first, we're just going to start over. There we go. All right. Yay! I've mastered technology. So, right here we've got Digital New Zealand's idea of a digital content lifecycle. And you can search Google for these, and there are as many different places that put them up have different cycles. But this one is a pretty basic and pretty succinct content lifecycle. There are 5 main stages to the life cycle and 2 corollaries: describing, managing, discovering, using and reusing objects, and also creating, which would be right at the front. I am going to be focusing on describing these life cycles. So the important thing, describing the objects in the life cycle. So the important thing to remember when looking at a digital life cycle is that it's not a single cycle. These cycles continuously occur. It is repeated for each object numerous times. Thus, we can recreate an object, we can describe it multiple times, we can tweak the policies that manage it, and of course, it can be discovered 1,000 times over in 500 new ways. It will also be uniquely used by each user. So at the Jewish Women's Archive, we decided if the description can be done many times, then why shouldn't many people be doing the description? And I don't mean multiple archivists. I mean multiple people with a capital P. Different people with different interests in the collection. We mean archivists who have a professional interest in the collection, the creators who have a personal connection to the collection, and also interested amateurs that often have more time and more expertise and sometimes some monetary resources that we do not have. What? That's new. So, why crowdsourcing the description? Crowdsourcing is the idea that if we put something out there, we can have a discussion or we can have a collaboration with the crowd, with the masses, with our users. So, why did JWA decide to do this? Well, to quote Max Evans in a recent American Archivist article, quote, "With so many records and so few resources to provide on-demand access to them, the problem seems intractable. More money alone will not solve the problem. Instead, archivists must fundamentally shift the way they think about their roles and develop alternative means and methods for doing archival work." So we have to. That's why we decided this. I'm the only archivist at the Jewish Women's Archive. I did not have time to add metadata records to our collections, which I will describe in a moment. So I decided to see if I could get some help from the creators and also from interested users and possibly researchers. So again, why creator source? Why would I go back to the creator, so creator sourcing instead of crowdsourcing description? One, there's beautiful animation. One, imagine a bicycle. It's a fast way to get information on materials that we don't have the expertise or resources to effectively describe. When a creator uploads an image or a letter to our website and to our collections, they know far more than I'm ever going to know reading that letter or seeing that image. They can tell me who James Smith was. Well, James Smith was from Brookline. He was my father's business partner. And I had a crush on him when I was 14, so this is a love letter to him. We know that James Smith is an older man, and we know that it's not James Smith, the kid that sits behind me in math class. The second reason to use creator source description and crowdsource description is that it democratizes our collections. Anyone with an internet connection can add to the archives, both objects and metadata, descriptive metadata specifically. Oh, look at that. So one wonderful example of creator source description is the September 11th archive. And this was put together by the Center for History and New Media out of George Mason University. And it's a collection of over 150,000 digital objects relating to the September 11th events. There are images, there are text descriptions of your memories from that day, there are emails, there are, I believe, audio in this one as well. And it's from people of every walk of life. This is not a collection that has been vetted in any way. They consider it a raw collection. So anyone who has uploaded something, they trust to have uploaded something appropriate. So, online collecting at the Jewish Women's Archive. This is what I actually know a fair amount about. We have had two projects that played with, as I like to say, online collecting. The first was Katrina's Jewish Voices, which was a collaboration with the Center for Jewish Southern Life. And its purpose was to document the effect of Hurricane Katrina on Jewish communities in the Gulf Coast region. To date, we're the only collection of this sort. It currently contains 2,600 digital objects, which are documents, images, blog posts, and emails. There is another probably 100 or so images that are video and, objects that are video and audio, but unfortunately the technology we used to build this system couldn't handle it at that point in time. In addition, we took 85 oral histories of women and men from that community, and those are currently going through a process of editing and metadata collection on those, but that's purely on the archivist's shoulders. The second project is called Jewish American Women and World War II. It is sort of builds on what we learned from Katrina's Jewish Voices. And it was conceived to meet the actuarial imperative facing women who lived through World War II. This time we staged it as a project where we collaborate with small historical societies to display not only their collections, but collections in the hands of community members. We gather those works with the help of the historical society through roadshows and also one-on-one consultation. This photo is one of our first that we collected, and it's a group of the Canteen Corps in Newport News. Does anybody actually know what the Canteen Corps is? Because I haven't been able to find that out. Anyone? No. Possibly the wrong crowd. All right. What type of metadata do we collect? Well, we learned early on with Katrina's Jewish Voices that we have to keep it basic. We have to keep it simple. Users do not want to fill out lots and lots of information. So we attempt to get the basic story, the creator name and email, the object name, its location, the keywords or tags associated with it, and then the description. Creator name and email, obviously only if it's going to be being uploaded or we're gathering it directly from the creator. The location, as close as we can get, it's not too big of a deal. And then keywords and tags. We don't use the term subject with users. It's a little bit more confusing. I tend to have subjects that are actually controlled vocabularies, either Library of Congress or now we've developed a thesaurus based on the UNESCO thesaurus. Keywords, for each project we've developed 10 to 15 keywords that a user can just automatically check off. So for the World War II project, there are things like the Roosevelts, Pearl Harbor, paid work, military service, things that are major touchstones within the experience of that time. Finally, description is what's most important to the Jewish Women's Archive. The description is where we ask the creator to tell the story behind the object. And the story behind the object in this case is, this is Private Thelma Klein. She was part of the United States Marine Corps Women's Reserve. She was one of the first women to become excited and donate some images to our site. And she told us that this was the best time in her life, that this was a period where she was allowed to be exactly what she thought she could be without a husband, without children. And she also mentioned that she struggled a lot after being in the Marine Corps Women's Reserve with going back into the house and back to a domestic life. All right. So, other metadata we collect. This is the boring stuff. I happen to like it a lot. We collect the ones and zeros using the National Library of New Zealand metadata extractor. We extract technical and preservation metadata, which is held in an XML file. And any administrative metadata is added when I vet the object. And generally, vetting takes a few moments. You know, as long as it's not offensive or completely off base, we accept it. So what are the pros of working on this user-generated description? Well, if we're getting the metadata directly from the creator, it gets to the heart of what these objects mean to the individuals who created them. It captures the story in context from the creator themselves. This is something that we struggle with when we gain a collection after someone has died, you know, recreating that context. So, again, it's a democratization of archival collections. It allows archivists to apply the Green and Meisner principles of more product, less process. I can get things in, they have a minimal amount of metadata attached to it, but I can put them up and wait for the next round of interaction to have more metadata about it. So that's what this part is about. Systems can be created to provide for iterative description. And iterative description is the idea that I can put something out with minimal description, and then once the crowd sees it and adds tags or metadata, that is the second round of description. So another pro is that we're allowing users to shape the resources to their needs. Stivlia and Jorgensen have written quite a bit about metadata in online collections. In this article in particular, they wrote about user-generated collection-level metadata in a photo-sharing system. So, quote, "While providers may optimize the content, amount, and quality of metadata based on available resources and their intended use, studies have indicated that the metadata provided may not necessarily be the same as that needed by end users. For instance, Jorgensen's research suggests that end users describe many more attributes than are commonly provided for in standard controlled vocabularies and metadata structures." Now, this is sort of backwards to what I said about users do not want to fill out lots of forms. Well, that's true, but they also will describe a lot more if you give them a free text box. So that brings us to the cons. Well, there's a lack of consistency in description. That's just something we may have to live with. We're very good at being consistent in archives. You know, we want to have consistent finding aids with a consistent level of description across the board, and that's just not possible anymore. So there's going to be a lack of consistency in the description. Secondly, it's a radical change in roles. We're giving up a lot of control. But it's something that I think we can test and find the correct balance for your repository, and something that will help you with your backlog, especially a backlog of digital materials. Online collecting raises questions of provenance and authenticity. We have just chosen to trust that people are going to put things up that are theirs, that they know a little bit of something about, and that they are not, that the photo Private Thelma Klein really is Thelma Klein and not Jane Smith from Omaha. We have not had a problem with this yet. I'm sure at some point somebody will try and pull the wool over all our eyes, but hopefully we can keep ourselves aware of this problem. So part of the problem with giving a user a big box to describe in is that we're going to need to make sure that our search systems can do full text searching so that we have most efficiency in the search results. That's no longer such a big problem as it was, but it's definitely something to keep in mind. So finally, this is difficult. That's one of the cons. It's a huge sea change in how we think about metadata and how we think about our own role, but we have to be ready for the ups and downs. And as long as we can anticipate them, I think that the difficulty will be well worth the challenge. So, in conclusion, this may feel like herding ducks. Herding cats was taken in another session, so I had to change that. But it's not easy. It's going to feel like you're all over the place. But as long as we understand that the change is necessary, we're going to have to adapt the way we collect metadata and we create metadata for survival, so we can stay relevant, so we can stay vibrant. And finally, you know, let's use our users. Let's use our researchers. They're our best allies. They love us just as much as we love them coming in and using our collections. So instead of getting a thank you, maybe instead of getting just a thank you and a book acknowledgement, maybe we can get them to add their ideas and descriptions to the materials they use. So thank you very, very much.
Good morning again, everyone. I'm going to switch gears just a little bit and talk about consortia agreements and collaboration to create successful digital projects. Again, my name is Lisa Schoberg, and I'm the college archivist at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. It's a small private Lutheran college, and we, like probably many of you in this room, have very little money, and it's just me. So we had to get creative in order to pursue digital collections. So I'm going to speak this morning about how we can bridge the gap between digital collections and limited resources with a small staff. More specifically, I'd like to give you a little bit of background on consortia and what I found in investigating the literature as we started our project. I'd also like to provide you with an overview of what Digital Horizons, that's our consortium, what it is and how we started it, how we began creating our collections and some of the background work that we did to make that successful for our members, and finally, how we have been able to sustain our collections. So let's start off with some background. Consortia, of course, are not new to any of us in this room. We're all familiar with how they have been used for collection development, cataloging, and, of course, digital collections. I found a lot of information about consortia in the library literature specifically with their recent discussions of collection preservation with Portico, and also some talk about institutional repositories and how universities specifically are collaborating to do that. The archival literature has been very helpful, too, in that they look at digital collections, of course, but also the use of consortia for EAD finding aids and those kinds of initiatives. What I found the literature to be very helpful with is providing information about the strengths of the consortial approach, pros and cons, and that kind of information. There's some information, too, about ideas for how to start up and maintain consortia. What we found as we started our organization is that we didn't really have a whole lot of idea how to begin doing this. And some of the fundamental information, like how do we admit new members, what kind of fee structures do we charge, and those kinds of concerns weren't always present. So That is the information that I want to share with you today. So if this is the kind of adventure that you want to take, you can hopefully learn something from our successes and our failures that we have learned from as well. So now that we've talked about some background, let's talk about what Digital Horizons is. Digital Horizons is a digital repository whose mission is to provide, maintain, and preserve a wide range of historical and significant content related specifically to Fargo-Moorhead and broadly to Minnesota and North Dakota. This project creates teaching, learning, and researching opportunities for lifelong learning. Like consortia that you may be involved with, we spent a lot of time planning our organization, and that the 2 years really that we planned some more really ended up being very beneficial to us. How our organization was created was through a grant with the Corporation of Public Broadcasting. And I was in a workshop the other day with Michael Miller. It was a records management workshop. And he said, luck is when opportunity and preparation coincide. And I found that to be very interesting because I think that was definitely the case for Concordia Archives and I know the other partners in our consortium. What happened was this grant opportunity brought a number of cultural institutions together to talk about what exactly our region needed. And one of the needs that we identified was a way to share the great wealth of resources in our area with not only our region, but also within any users anywhere in the world that might be interested in them. So the organizations that ended up jumping on the bandwagon to pursue this opportunity were the Concordia Archives, the Institute for Regional Studies and University Archives at North Dakota State University, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the State Historical Society of North Dakota. And as you can see from this list, we're somewhat eclectic. We have private and public organizations, large and small organizations, government and non-government. So it's really been interesting to work with the wide range of experience that we have in our consortium. Once our group united, we decided that it was really important to lay down the framework of our organization. We as archivists all know how important that planning process is. And what we did was we created a partnership agreement. And this slide just shows the very first part of what we came up with. We created our mission, vision, goals, that kind of thing. But we also went into great detail about what we were each going to bring to the table so that we knew what resources we had available. And this document also describes our levels of membership, which I'm going to go into in a minute. According to Peters in his 2002 article titled Digital Repositories, the author states that one of the benefits of consortia is that they allow for economies of scale and avoidance of unnecessary redundancies in experience and computing capacity among members. And we have definitely found that to be true in our consortium. What we decided to do was split our resources for the good of the order because we did not have the resources available to supply our own, buy our own server, supply technical staff, and all those things that you need. So one organization supplied the server and the technical staff. So the NDSU is responsible for that part of our organization. Another maintains the financial workings of the organization. That's actually what I'm responsible for. And we also maintain the records of Digital Horizons. We as archivists all know how important that job is to document what we're doing. So that's what I do. And finally, Prairie Public so graciously offered to help us with transferring analog to digital materials because they had those capabilities. This method has worked really well for us. We have saved time through peer consultancy, joint decision making, and joint development, which are all things identified by Cox and Onuf in their 2003 article titled Digital Anxiety and Cooperation in the Networked World. Oops. So once we got going, we decided, well, we figured out that other people might want to join in our consortia too, because we were experiencing so many benefits. And what we did was we identified three levels of membership. The first was clients, and they use the software primarily for an in-house inventory system. So an example of this is the Concordia College has an art collection, and they're scanning their images, actually imaging the art that they have and developing metadata, but only people that have or need access to it can use it. Then we have associates. Those are people that use the software to share their collections with anybody that has access to Digital Horizons. And finally, partners. And those are the people who use the software for in-house or to share their resources, but they are the ones responsible for governing the organization. And we really wanted to limit the number of people who participated in that element, not because we didn't want other people's ideas, but there's a point where you get too many minds working on something, and then it's more chaotic than it would be if we just have some representatives. So people can join, or organizations can join at any one of those levels. And we have developed fee structures and applications and all those kinds of things to help through that process. So after we created the foundation of our organization, we started creating our collections. And I'm sure all of you have probably used or seen many of the standards that exist for metadata development and scanning and selection. And we used a lot of that information to create our own standards or our applications of those standards. We decided that we wanted to create what we have termed our data dictionary. And we spend about a year working on this, and what it does is delineate each field that we use in our metadata, not only what that field is, but also how it should look, and provides examples. And this was to make sure that things were consistent, but also to help those people who may not have as much familiarity with that process, so clients that come in down the road that don't exactly know what we're expecting from the metadata. We also spent another year working on our website. This was a very interesting process, but I think we finally came up with something that we were able to share the information that we wanted to and to make it as usable as we could so that our users could search our collections right from the homepage and to browse and sort the way that we anticipate they would want to. We're still evaluating how that is working to make changes as necessary. And just so you know, this is one of the, so you have an idea of what it looks like. We use ContentDM. I'm sure most of you in this room are familiar with ContentDM. Yeah? So that's nothing new, I'm sure, but that's what our images actually look like. So now that Digital Horizons has collections available, we have been in the process of sustaining our organization. Yeats and Guy warned in their 2006 article that titled Collaborative Working for Large Digitization Projects, that project complexity, the need for new focuses for innovation, and the provision and development of new skills can threaten sustainability. And I'm sure we have all encountered these threats, if you work in small archives especially, with how to keep your program going with these limited resources. And we have developed some ways that we have been able to maintain our consortium, and they have been working fairly well. The first is that the fee that we charge every year, we charge a maintenance fee for partners, associates, and clients. And that maintenance fee pays for our maintenance fee for the software, but it also goes into a pool of monies that we keep banking for training. Because there are going to be software changes, and we just need refreshers and that kind of thing. And that way, we have been able to pay for that to make sure that we are on the up and up with what we need to know. The other thing we have done is created an administrative team. And that administrative team is comprised of one representative from each partnering organization. And we meet once every 2 months at least just to talk about how things are going and to brainstorm new ideas and develop the website and data dictionary was something that team did. And finally, through this whole process, we have really become a close-knit group. We bond over coffee quite a bit, and we just have a great relationship that we are able to provide assistance and resources to each other and help each other out. It has only been through joining Digital Horizons that I know the Concordia Archives and my colleagues at NDSU, Prairie Public, and the State Historical Society have been able to realize their dream of having digital collections just because of limited resources. So I realize that it sounds like it might be a lot of work, but really the amount of work going into the consortium pooled together from each one of us has saved us all time and effort and made great accomplishments. So the next time you hear the words small staff, limited resources, and digitization in the same sentence, realize that they can have a relationship with collaboration. Thank you.
Morning again, everyone. Thank you for your patience and for sticking with us here. I'll try to get the mic in a place so you can hear me. Seems reasonable. As was mentioned in my introduction previously, I am the archivist at Northern State University, where I am responsible at this point not only for the physical archives, but also for the digital project that happens there. What I'm going to talk about here today is basic ways to integrate and keep a digital project as part of your workflow, as part of your day-to-day activities, and hopefully sustain it over the long term. And I, too, am having slideshow issues, so if I can figure this out, we can move forward. Just click on there. It's not important. I'll move forward. Yep. If you don't mind, I will just move forward without the slideshow. I can see it here, and it looks great, so take my word for it. Those of you paying close attention will notice that we have coordinated our efforts unintentionally. Who said archivists aren't creative, right? Come up with the same pattern. Okay, you know who I am. I am at Northern State University in Aberdeen, South Dakota. Who here would have an idea where Aberdeen specifically is on a map? Just a show of hands. This is fun. Okay. We have a few. That's good. Aberdeen is a small town in northeastern South Dakota, home of approximately 30,000 people, which is smaller than the undergrad population of the University of Texas and about, a third of the size of their football crowd on every Saturday. So we're small, is what I'm saying. Our institution is about 2,000 full-time equivalent students. And we have traditionally not had maybe a strong archives program. We're working very hard to remedy that. So what I'll talk about here today is our experience as a startup, as a small startup, perhaps some lessons that you can apply in your case, perhaps not. I hope not to be terribly boring. If you've already done this, bear with me. Hopefully there's something you can glean from my trials and errors. Second question for the crowd. Who here works in a one-person shop? It's just them running the show. Okay, good. There'll be at least some misery loves company, right? So before I launch into our heartwarming tale of the little library that could, I'll talk just a little bit about the project itself and where we're at right now. Those of you looking for the completed 5,000, 10,000 image project, that's not us right now. We're doing what we can. We're in the hundreds instead of thousands, but I feel like we have learned something along the way, and that's what we'll talk about here today. Initially, as I stated, we were, I would say, a fledgling archive, fledgling manuscript collectors. We were sending out items to Minneapolis to have them digitized, the items that were deemed rare, fragile, and so on. At which point the question was asked, why don't we do this in-house? Which shows either some creativity or some extreme, me being extremely naive, perhaps. We're not a part of a consortia. We took this on as an individual instance. We went out there and looked at what was there for material. We wrote grants, some more successful than others, to fund the startup. We went with a prepackaged content DM database program. And as soon as we were finished, the state of South Dakota put together a digitization project that we were by mandate to be a part of. So it has been an interesting journey for us from startup on our own to part of a consortia to kind of straddling the fence on both of those, which is as pleasant as it sounds sometimes. My input as far as starting a digital project and how to perhaps keep it going was broken down into 3 points, which I can see here and you cannot see. The first being careful planning before you start forth. The second being identifying and using the resources at hand. And the final word of wisdom, which is a scary thought, but me giving words of wisdom at this point, would be to have reasonable expectations. All these are born from experience, some good experience, some bad experience. So in planning your project, the first bit of wisdom I would impart on you would be to temper your excitement. Like I said, we are a little naive in starting out. You want to scan everything, you want to make it available tomorrow and so on. Be reasonable. Plan to do easily measurable and completable projects that you can then assess their impact and move forward. Think about the big picture. In our case, we're talking one person getting us up to speed from non-collecting to not only collecting on campus, but also the region. How is this going to impact our processing ability, our ability to answer the reference questions we get, and continue to do the things that we do as a library with the staff that we have? Can we afford this? Obviously, money is an issue. We're talking about individual institutions with minimal resources. As I said, in our case, we were fortunate enough to get grants to get us started, but we also had to go and pitch the whole project to the university administration to lobby for support, albeit on a not exactly a huge scale, but they had to buy in as well. And then finally, what is a success for your program? What is it that you're shooting for, and is it accessible? In our case, we didn't start out with that guidance, which has led to some issues of maybe going too many directions at once, has led to some bottlenecks as far as workflow goes. So understand what it is that you want to do. Make sure that's manageable. Make sure it fits within your institution's mission, and then by all means move forward. Equipment is a major issue. Anyone who logs on to the archives and archivist listserv has probably seen the question of what scanner should I buy many, many times. Several versions of that discussion are probably in my saved Outlook files right now. We went through the same thing. As I said, our project stemmed from a lot of money going into having commercial digitization people handle our materials and asking, how can we do this better? We have been fortunate by way of the consortium. We are a different consortium than the North Dakota group, but a similar type of situation that has brought us additional equipment. We have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to equipment, and that has happened not only because of the grant and the startup funding, but because we identified and participated in a regional consortium. And then finally, staffing. Again, we're talking about planning for a successful project. If you're one person, obviously it's pretty easy to get the pulse of the situation as far as how much time and interest there is in digitizing materials. In our case, this is one area where we're very fortunate. On the staffing front, initially we started lobbying to recoup a position where someone had retired, and we've effectively gone from a one-person shop to a one-person plus assistant shop, and that assistant has a background in digital photography. So don't stop dreaming, I guess. In our case, the big picture, how does this fit with our institution's mission and so on? The digital project has allowed us to expand into collecting areas and to get collections that we would not have gotten before. And that's one of the things that I think has been a real positive on our front. People who are willing to donate their collections to us and are willing to provide us with the metadata and the background info solely because they want this material to be available elsewhere. In the past, as wonderful as some people may see Aberdeen, South Dakota as being, to many it was seen as the end of the road, where if your collections go there, they'll never be seen again. The digital program has allowed us to kind of dispel that notion, if only as a on the front of a repository as opposed to perhaps a tourist destination. It also has allowed us, and again, I didn't ask the question who's at an academic institution, it's proven to be a very effective outreach tool to the campus on the whole. We've partnered with everybody from the Indian Studies program to the German department, where this fall we'll be offering translation classes using German language correspondence we have, where students all across the state will then be translating those materials. So we get the translation, they get the work, everybody wins. My second major point, that being of using the resources at hand, those of you that are in individual shops know very well, you can't know everything from the outset. Lisa referred to that. If you are like me and prefer to print out documents, you likely will find yourself overwhelmed with a pile of paper as you look at standards, as you look at consortial agreements, as you look at all of these things. There's a wide, wide variety of them out there. It's important to be selective. It's important to ask around. As Lisa mentioned, they worked within North Dakota. The people in North Dakota have been very helpful to us. The people in Minnesota have been very helpful to us, if nothing else, to tell us things that did and didn't work for them, and perhaps to give us an example of the structure of what it is that we want to do. In our case, we've relied heavily, as I said, online to find documentation and put things together. When the time came for a consortia to be formed, we worked very closely with the people in Minnesota and Wisconsin ultimately to put together our metadata standards, which are slightly different than those that they created. Finally, under the heading of reasonable expectations, I would love to show you the quote that I have here, but unfortunately that is not possible apparently. So I will have to read it to you, which is unfortunate. As I mentioned, set project parameters from the beginning. This is an area that we erred in, perhaps what could have been catastrophically, as we spent resources on a variety of different things initially. We have since tapered that back and focused on one or two specific manageable or semi-manageable collections. And don't underestimate how long it will take you to learn equipment. And don't forget to include time for equipment failure, perhaps the server doesn't work, and so on. I'll just read you the quote that I have here from an article on the that was about a digitization project with sheet music. The most useful thing we've learned from this project was that you can never overestimate the amount of time it will take to create a quality digital product. That's exactly what we found as well, and that time comes from implementing metadata standards, learning how to use equipment, making sure the server is working properly, and so on. I can't say it often enough. We've lost extensive periods of time, not enough obviously to defeat us, but enough to make us frustrated. And finally, digitization in a one-person shop. Initially, the desire to do a project like this can be daunting. You may hear from multiple avenues, as we did, that perhaps this is not the greatest idea. You should leave it to the experts and so on. The server, software, equipment can be daunting, but there are helps available in the form of webinars, regional user groups, and so on. So that is not necessarily enough to disqualify you. The fact that you're a one-person shop can prove to be an advantage in this case, as you know the collections best, as you know what is used, and you can identify important pieces, things that are perhaps deteriorating physically, and so on. And in the end, partnerships do make a huge difference. I mean, we have what we have at hand. It's up to us to be creative, to take on additional partners, perhaps, and like I said, maybe play politics, lobby the powers that be to get more people on the ground, or perhaps even use volunteers, which we have seen to be particularly effective in our case. In conclusion, the slides were really, really good, I promise. Really good, top shelf stuff. But anyways, it can be done. It can be done on a small scale. It can be done in a small place. I don't stand here professing to be the expert, but we have been very fortunate in a lot of ways. We have moved from almost nothing to something substantial, at least substantial to me, in a fairly quick time frame. And it can be done with an individual. I'm not a tech expert. I've learned how to run servers and do all the things that need to be done. It can be done. I'm here to be the word of encouragement. And I thank you for your time and apologize for the technical issues.
Thank you very much to all three of our speakers. I'm very sorry that the slides didn't work. But as it has been my experience as a teaching assistant once, people sometimes pay more attention when there are no PowerPoint slides visible. And please make sure to ask Robert any questions that you might have if you think you didn't get all the information. We would like to open up this session now for questions. And if you have a question, please stand up and try to speak loudly so that we can all hear you. The question is about using metadata and the concept of maybe providing less control from the side of the archivist and more control and handing it over to users.
So basically what we designed at the Jewish Women's Archive was a system where there was a selection of controlled vocabulary that users could use. Those were the keywords. So the Roosevelts was actually, you know, Franklin, or Roosevelt, comma, Franklin Delano, or whatever it is. And then, yes, I will go back and look at the tags that were added. And if it is a famous name, I'll add the controlled version, the authority version, and remove the other. If it is just Smith, comma, Jane, I'm going to leave it be. I don't know which Jane Smith it is. Maybe we have really five different Jane Smiths in our collection, but currently that's not an issue. So it's finding that balance, I guess I would say.
My question is all copyright.
So if someone uploads their image or their document to our website, the agreement that they quote-unquote sign by hitting the upload button, and you know, we have them type in their initials. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't actually tell you how strong of an agreement that is. Assigns a Creative Commons license to it. Generally, we use the not-for-profit equal attribution, not-for-profit, and we allow derivatives. If there's something else they would like to assign to it, or if they'd like to retain all copyright to that object, that's something that they would have to actually email us about and we would start a discussion on. No one has ever said, I want to retain copyright. I don't know if people understand what it says when we have the sign that, you know, the page that comes up and says, you know, by signing this, you are agreeing to a Creative Commons license, which allows JWA and any blah, 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 blah. I don't know if anybody actually understands that beyond those of us who are, like, Creative Commons junkies. But we have yet to have a problem with it. So, I mean, if it's obviously a portrait, we have another section of our site where it's called We Remember, and they're personal obituaries for women who have died in probably about the last decade. And so there's, I don't know, 50 or 60 women remembered in that part of the site right now. And family members will send us images. And I have on numerous occasions actually had to go to the photographer and get written permission from the photographer. But in general, Katrina's Jewish Voices and World War II, they're either very old photos where that's not really a concern, or you can tell that it's a snapshot that the person themselves or the contributor themselves took. I think that's just an oversight, to be totally honest. We do, when an object is created within our system, there's a date captured, the date of creation. But yeah, I think that was just an oversight. I apologize. Date is included.
I have a question for Lisa and Robert. Both of you are using ContentDM. Why did you decide to go with this software?
Can you hear me? We looked at a number, but we actually went down to St. John's University. Is anybody familiar with that in Minnesota? And they are using that for their digital collections, and we spent a great deal of time watching how they were using it, and they showed us how they were doing their batch uploading and a lot of the features that they were able to use. And so that really helped us decide that that was the route we wanted to go, and also because at the time we didn't notice any other vendors that allowed us to buy one license for multiple organizations, and ContentDM was one of them that did allow for that. So that really helped us financially.
We took in all the factors that were mentioned by Lisa, plus the fact that we don't have the programming staff that would be able to take on an open source product. Plain and simply, it was the one that worked for us, ability-wise, skills-wise in-house. I'm not on the OCLC payroll. I spent many a day cursing the program as we updated to the most current version, but it does work for the most part for us. It allows flexibility for people to do things in different locations, and it doesn't require us to have a ton of programming knowledge.
Any more questions? What I found really interesting about Robert's presentation is that one of the results of the successful projects were that they actually could hire an additional person to work on digitization projects. What new projects are you working on right now, and how does this new person help you?
This new person is capable of handling the equipment in ways that I perhaps would not have been. As I mentioned, her background is in digital photography and image manipulation. So not that we're manipulating images, but she knows how to run the stuff. What are we working on? Currently, the main project we're working on is it's actually a very large physical collection, 300-plus linear feet of, that's large to us, material about damming of the Missouri River and the use of that material, the use of that water by farmers throughout the region, ranchers. We are hoping, we keep promising the folks at the Western Waters Digital Library that our records will be ready to harvest very soon. As I mentioned, there are bottlenecks, namely me. I'm the one who does the subject headings. So unfortunately, I do get pulled many different directions, and there are several hundred waiting for me when I return home. But that's the main project that's on the table. The collection that I alluded to us getting that we wouldn't have gotten otherwise was actually a collection of material from a German from Russia family that settled just west of Aberdeen. They have the family has since relocated throughout the country, but they figured they could donate the material to us. People all over the country could see it, including family members who are helping us identify people in photos and so on. So that's what we are working on right now. And none of that would have been happening if it was just me.
If there are no more questions, I think we've reached the end of this session. Thank you very much for coming. And again, thank you to our speakers, who I think have given us very good examples for how archivists with limited funds can actually work on digital projects and complete them successfully. Thanks a lot.